Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and today I'm talking to Adrian Powers. Hey, Adrian.
Hey, Jeff. How's it going?
Excellent. Adrian is here because he is the writer and director of Brolga, which I'm going to say right off the bat, I watched it again this morning before our talk, and I cried again. In fact, this was the first time I watched it with my life partner, and she always mocks me if I cry during a film. So it was really hard for me today to be so emotionally swept up by this film Brolga that Adrian wrote and directed. And Adrian's here because Brolga was at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival in 2019, where it won the coveted Programmer's Prize. And even more importantly, it's in the Discovery Indie Film TV series, which is on Amazon Prime. So you just go to Amazon Prime Video, go to Season 3. It's in Episode 4 with the Wind Phone, which I'm not even joking. The Wind Phone and Brolga, that's the Oscar episode of that season. That's the episode with two films that should have and could have been in that like top five world of Oscar best live action short. Just wonderfully made. Brolga's a wonderfully made film. I love everything about Brolga.
That's so nice of you to say.
Well, I'm not making it up, Adrian. It's for real. And but before we get to Brolga, I always start off just asking, you know, you are a filmmaker extraordinaire. What were your early inspirations? What got you into the craft? Were you a video camera, running around with a video camera as a kid, or just a movie fan? Just how'd you get started?
Yeah, it's and once again, it's so nice of you to say. And you know, all the films that I think are in the Discover Indie Film Showcase are so great, and we're so happy and proud to be included amongst them. So thank you again. I think my story in terms of my motivation and my inspiration to get into film is pretty cliched, and we could just hit all the traditional, you know, spots along the journey. Just, you know, loved genre film and stuff as a kid, you know, Star Wars, Superman, all those great, and all the other greats, you know, of cinema history as well. Both of my parents, avid movie lovers, and I was really raised on movies as a kid. And I got to give massive, eternal gratitude to my dad, because when it comes to the shooting 8mm films as a kid story, then became shooting video, a tape as a kid, and now it's shooting on, now everyone's doing it on their iPhone. But back in the day, it was my dad who had, you know, the family video camera, who would, you know, really lean into supporting me, wanting to be. And I remember when I was probably 5 or 6, I gathered a bunch of friends together, and we did a remake, a backyard remake of Ghostbusters 2, the second Ghostbusters, which I actually love and think is a really, really wonderful movie and needs to be revisited. But that was a situation where my dad was not only filming me and my friends dressed up in Ghostbusters attire and reenacting it all in our backyard, but he actually had a tape, a VHS tape of the movie, and was using rudimentary VHS, like editing technology, to splice bits from the film. So we'd have establishing shots of New York City, or like the Ecto-1 rounding a corner, and then it would cut to our car rounding a corner, and then the kids would get out. So really sweet, wholesome, lovely kind of family story of being, you know, nurtured in filmmaking. And I loved, you know, playing with all the toys. I'm one of those kind of people, I think, that you really, really got into filmmaking, not just through a love of cinema, but also through my love of technology and love of computers, because I was born in 86. So when I was a teenager, we had, you know, rudimentary early video editing stuff that was available for the consumer. So anytime someone asks me this question, I always just want to put out into the ether a special bit of thanks to whoever was on the team for Windows Movie Maker with Windows XP, which came out in 2001, 20 years ago now. But that was a piece of software, rudimentary editing software, which is like, you know, iMovie level, you know, probably not as good as iMovie. But this was a piece of software that allowed kids like me to actually start toying around and making films and cutting digital films together. And And from there, I taught myself how to use, more conventional video editing software and stuff like that. And so I'm really grateful for people who had the foresight to say, we should just put this in there. And I don't think even they would have comprehended how much of an impact it had on a whole generation of people. I've always really, really, really loved movies. And then I decided to go to film school in
2009. But middle school, high school, were the projects getting more and more sophisticated?
Yeah, like I made a bunch of little movies, with my friends and stuff in high school, but I wouldn't necessarily say they were more sophisticated. Again, like when I was kind of, 16, 17, 18, that was right around the time of the peak of the popularity of like Jackass and all that kind of, those stunt-based MTV style insanity. And so I think we were doing a lot more of that kind of stuff, like being troublemakers and going around and doing pranks and stuff. But I was still filming it and then spending 40, 50 hours cutting these things together, which were, ostensibly jokes and just friends hanging out. And I was putting title sequences and syncing it to music and stuff. And so I actually got to confess, it never really occurred to me or became a concrete idea that I would do it as a career until much later. I had always kind of assumed that I would pursue a creative career. There was a whole time there when I was kind of dabbling in web design, and then there was time there where I was contemplating pursuing being a writer of a more conventional sense, all complete pie in the sky dreams that wouldn't possibly sustain you, but managed to somehow pull it off. And then I went to university and studied philosophy, and when I was at university, at the University of Sydney, I did do a lot of film courses. There were lots of film, parts of that, and lots of particular units of film study, and which I absolutely adored and loved. But it actually wasn't until about 2006, and I was the assistant manager of an EB Games, aka GameStop, here in Sydney, and one of my colleagues who talking and connected and bonded over movies almost instantly. I remember. Distinctly, the very first time we kind of connected on that was I was running for the back door and I whistled the Indiana Jones theme as I was trying to make it to the back door. And he suddenly was like, and he continued whistling the theme. And I was like, okay, we're kindred dorks. But after that, it became apparent that we both really love movies. And, he literally just said to me point blank once as we were leaving the store, he was like, you should go to film school. And I was like, yeah, I feel like a real idiot. I'm like, what a moron.
No, it always takes someone like that.
And my mom did a lot of work towards getting, pushing me to doing that. She really encouraged me and was fantastically, really supportive of that. So there's a bunch of people.
Fantastic. I also want to add that as easy as it is to downplay the Jackass sort of skateboarding / pranking kind of filmmaking, Spike Jonze came right out of that.
Exactly.
A lot of actually skateboarding videos and such led to really significant filmmaking.
Yeah, 100%. Absolutely.
I think the skills you learned editing to music, cutting to beats, all kinds of stuff. That's probably better than sitting down and making serious dramas as a kid.
I think you're totally right. And, Spike Jonze is still doing that. He's involved with the new Jackass movie. He's shepherded that whole thing for years. So I totally agree. There is a punk rock, MTV, rock and roll sensibility to all that stuff that is still fosters a lot of creativity.
Absolutely. All right. So you decide to go to film school. Totally loved it. Wonderful experience.
Yeah, I had a wonderful experience. It's been really great. Anytime I have an opportunity to talk about this film or any of the other films that I've worked on and someone's nice enough to kind of have this conversation and is interested, you go like, okay, so what's your path and what did you think? How did you find it? When the film school thing comes up, some people are like, yeah, absolutely. I went to film school. It was great. Or I went to film school and I didn't find it that useful. Or I didn't go to film school and I felt that was better because you go to the school of hard knocks, you learn as you go, et cetera, et cetera. And I completely acknowledge all that. And I think the best thing about the experience that I had at film school is that I went to a film school here in Sydney called the International Film School Sydney, IFSS, which is now not called that. Now it's called AFTT. But their philosophy of film school was you do it. So it's not you go in and you sit around and talk and intellectualize and discuss theory and thesis all day long, even though there was a lot of that. They had a really rigid belief that you've got to make the stuff. You've got to be boots on the ground, learning the technique, learning the craft. And not only that, one of the things that really drew me to their philosophy was that they had a holistic attitude towards film. There's a lot of film schools that believe that when you subscribe and you go to that film school, you nominate or you either select what you want to do or you get chosen into the stream you want to do. And if it's directing, then you do the directing thing and you work with the directors and you learn about that and you liaise with the other departments, but you stay in your lane. That's what you're there to study. If you're costuming, you're editing, whatever, that's what you're there to do. And I personally don't believe that that's the most fruitful way to learn. I think that you do need to have that holistic experience where you learn all the aspects of the craft, not only so that you know what they are and so that you understand how to apply them, but so you know how to communicate with the people that work in those departments. And so when I was at film school, they said, okay, great. So while you're at this school, you will be directing 6 movies and you will be crewing everyone else's movies and you'll be alternating between those roles. So you'll be writing and directing 6 movies, which is fantastic. There's so many film schools which, you know, pit their students against each other. You've got to make a pitch to see who's worthy of directing a film, and the people that don't make the cut have to crew the movies and don't get a chance to tell their stories. And this was great. They were like, you're going to do 6 films. Unbelievable. And, you know, some of them are going to have $600 budgets. Some of them are going to have $3,000 budgets, which might seem frugal, but you've got $150,000 worth of camera equipment, sound gear, lenses, studio space, connections, all editing equipment, computers for post-production, sound mixing studio, ADR booth. So you've got all the stuff. You can do a short film for $3,000 if you're basically paying for, you know, food and actors' wages. And you would go in and you would do that, but you would also assistant direct on someone's film. You would do the sound for someone's film. You would do the editing on someone's film. You would produce someone else's film. And so everyone got this incredible rock tumble experience where we're thrown into this stuff and people's strengths and their weaknesses start to become apparent and you can play to that. And it was wonderful. I was there for 2 years and it was, you know, I went to high school and had one high school experience. Then I went to university and had a university experience, but going to film school was absolutely my favorite. And it was a broad spectrum of students there. You know, I went there when I was, you know, I think when I was 23 or 24, there were students there who were 18 straight out of high school. There were people there in their 60s who were like, you know what, I want to do this. And a lot of them were so great to learn from and speak to. So I thought it was a wonderfully fun experience and it taught me an immense amount about the craft and the theory of filmmaking. And it gave me the means to make the short films that gave me my career. So I could not speak more in approval of that type of film school experience.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think everything you said resonates with me. And I'll add, doing all those roles that you didn't intend to do on a set gives you appreciation for how hard it is as well. You know, people who are in a directing-only program might just bark at people because they've never had to be a gaffer. So they just don't see that being a gaffer might be harder than what they're doing in that moment.
100%. I will never forget the day that the Steadicam guy showed up and he was like, hey, okay, guys, we're going to learn about the Steadicam. It was a whole day of the Steadicam and learning what it can do and how it looks and shooting stuff on it, then looking at the footage. And of course they're like, okay, so you're all going to put the Steadicam on to see how this feels. And you know, we're like, great. Can't wait. We get it on. It's like, okay, this is intense. Oh, wow, you can do a lot with it. And then 5 minutes into it, you're like, get this thing off me. I am dying. Like the core strength and the muscle strength you need to operate this thing is unbelievable. And there are guys that are operating that thing for hours a day. And you're just like, okay.
Yeah, no, it's a marathon. It's an Olympic event.
Yeah.
Putting that on. It's like 30, 40 pounds of gear at least.
Yeah, it's like holding a minigun. Like it's crazy.
Yeah, it is. It's the army. It's the closest. I mean, there's a lot of comparisons between the roles in a battalion and a film crew, totally. But that is definitely the gunner is the Steadicam.
That's right. If any of y'all want to see what I'm talking about, Google it or just watch James Cameron's Aliens, and you'll see Vasquez, that machine gun that she's the plasma rifle or whatever she's using. That's literally just a modified Steadicam. She's just wearing a Steadicam with a prop attached to the end of it, and
that's,
you'll see
absolutely
that thing's formidable.
Fantastic. So I picked up that you said the short films that gave you your career came after film school. So tell me about those.
Well, those were the films that I made in film school. So, you know, like I said, we were given this amazing opportunity, six movies, and we the great thing about that was we had specific briefs for all those films. You know, this film, the very first film we had to make was, you know, maximum 6 minutes, no dialogue. It's like, okay. And then the next one was maximum 5 minutes, no dialogue, must be black and white, and has to be a lyrical moment, like a moment that's not necessarily a story, but just kind of a beautiful moment you've captured on film, which I kind of turned into a story anyway and, you know, had fun with. But, you know, we ultimately got the money to do a series of major projects that were like, okay, now just do the movie you want to make. Just apply what you've learned and do what you want to make. And I made, you know, the first one of those that I made was a movie called Scruples, which is a kind of crime thriller, undercover cop thing, inspired, very heavily inspired by, you know, Martin Scorsese. And, you know, I had to get that one out of my system. And that was a film that, you know, I wrote in 2010. And the people I chose to collaborate with me on that, to wind back a minute, on my very first day of film school, the head of school, Duncan Thompson, who is a man I'm eternally grateful for teaching me some very valuable lessons about filmmaking, they put on a presentation that showed some of the previous students' major works, or rather it was like a little sizzle reel that kind of showed some choice moments, like a hype reel. And there was this little segment that featured this actor, this unbelievably charismatic actor who I was like, wow, that guy's incredible. And at the end of it, I was like, what was that film? I spoke to Duncan, like, what was that film? He's like, oh, this is this film by this filmmaker. And I'm appalled. I can't remember the name of the film or the filmmaker. But the actor was Johan Earl, who is an Aussie actor here in Sydney. And I was like, wow, he's incredible. And Duncan said, yeah, the great thing about Johan is that he's also an armorer. He's a film armorer. So whenever you want to do a movie that involves guns or pyrotechnics, you know, it's really beneficial to be able to have your armorer also be an actor. And I was like, wow, that's really interesting. Fast forward a year and I'm designing this Scruples thing. And I was like, I think I'd like to speak to that guy about being in this movie, even though this was a film which effectively involved him being a hitman. And the other film had involved him being a hitman, but you know, he's kind of an intense guy. Got in touch with him, pitched him the movie. He liked it. We made this movie. You know, it was an interesting process because it developed in the edit, and you know, we did a couple of reshoots and stuff on it. But the film was really, really well received. It won the kind of the film school's kind of screening competition that they had for that year, and then that film got into a bunch of film festivals all over the world, culminating with it amazingly got into it this competition called Your Film Festival, which was this competition being run by Ridley Scott, Michael Fassbender, YouTube, and Emirates, the airline. It was this big, conglomerate enterprise that was also a collaborator with the Venice Film Festival. And basically, this was this movement by YouTube to want to position YouTube as a space for filmmakers and storytellers to put their content. Anyway, I entered into this competition with the film. Out of 15,000 entries, the film was one of the 50 semi-finalists. Then it became a finalist, which meant the film screened at the Venice Film Festival in 2012. We got taken over to Dubai and then for Emirates, then over to the Venice Film Festival. We went to the premiere of The Master. You know, it was just this unbelievable experience, you know, met and had drinks with Michael Fassbender, and, you know, had a pitch meeting with Scott Free. And that really allowed me to have a career. Like, you know, when people talk about, you know, do a short film, it's a great calling card. And people go, oh, no, who cares about short films anymore? Totally not true. You know, that film then literally, from that, I was able to start getting work on a feature, and it's completely all snowballed from there. So it's all thanks to that little short film I made in film school.
Amazing. Amazing story. I'm so happy for you that happened. That is incredibly special. That's like you didn't get a winning lottery ticket because it was based upon the quality of the work. But you know, that's
lovely.
Pretty amazing.
It was unbelievable. And I will say the last thought on that was that it was great because for that 1 week that we were on that all expenses paid trip, I mean, like they flew us first class. We had all these people waiting on us. And I was like, I'm really dipping my toe into, I'm sincerely, genuinely like dipping my toe into like an A-list experience. And I know now that's not something you need to worry about trying to pursue in life. You know what I mean? It's weird and strange and it, I have to, I'm such a, I like to think of myself as a relatively well-mannered person. When you're saying thank you to that many people a day who are not used to being thanked for anything they do, it's a very weird dynamic, you know, like, thank you so much. Like, that's okay. And I'm like, oh, this is just so stressful. So I was like, great. I've had this and I never want to be famous because it's just weird.
Brilliant. Wonderful. Well, so that was, you said 2010? Oh, 2012.
2012.
That was in 2012.
2012.
And then you said a feature. Did you not make any more shorts after that right away?
Well, it's funny because to connect it to the dots of what we're, you know, the real reason we're talking today is because Brolga was conceived in film school. Like I designed the movie, wrote it, and shot portions of it in that 2009 to 2010 period. As my ultimate major work for film school, but right after I finished, I screened Brolga, and anyone who's seen the film knows the film runs for about 16 minutes. I screened a rough cut of the movie, which was 35 minutes long. At film school, and they were like, "Okay, so this obviously needs a lot of work," and then basically. Film school wrapped up, you know, like I was like, okay, I've got so much to do, but film school's ending. I'm kind of looking for what I'm going to do as a career after this. And, you know, I was like, okay, great. Took all their notes down and then shelved Brolga. And then after film school, right out of the gate. And again, I'm just unbelievably lucky for this. Right out of the gate, Johan, the actor who I had worked with in Scruples, the gentleman who I'd seen in the film on my orientation day, got in touch with me and he says, "Hi, Adrian. I am putting together a feature film set in World War I about soldiers stranded in no man's land between trenches in World War I. I am writing in it, producing it, starring in it, and directing it. And it's a passion project of mine, but that's going to spread me completely thin. So we had such a wonderful experience on Scruples. Would you be interested in coming on board, working on the script with me, co-directing the movie with me, and editing the movie?" And I said, "Of course."
Okay. You can't say no.
Of course. Of course. And you know, some people were like, "You're going to co-direct, like, you know, is that going to be, you know, is he going to be a megalomaniac? Is this a vanity thing? What's that experience going to be like? You're co-directing this thing. What's the?" And I was like, "I have a pretty good feeling about it. I think we're going to be fine. I think we gel really well." And we did a lot of pre-production. We did a lot of storyboarding and shot design and whatnot. And then we just went headfirst into it. It was an unbelievably intense experience. I mean, the film is available on Amazon Prime for anyone who'd like to watch it. It's called Forbidden Ground throughout the world. It's called Battleground in the United States. And that, you know, that experience is a podcast all its own. Like, talking about the production of Forbidden Ground is literally its own podcast. But it was a really great experience, and co-directing with Johan was great. He was obviously featured a lot in the movie. So when he was acting, he was like, "I need you to take the reins here whilst I'm acting." But whenever he wasn't acting, we would sit there and discuss. It was a wonderful experience. It was my first time working on a feature. And I'm still really eternally grateful to him for that opportunity.
That's fantastic. And I have to say, I completely understand your enthusiasm, because it wasn't like someone was coming to you who you barely knew. I mean, you had worked with him, you directed him, you'd been on set with him. So it wasn't, exactly. It wasn't a gray area.
Exactly. And the film that we had worked on had been, you know, again, this actually predates, the thing in Venice. All of these things were kind of happening one after the other, you know, ticking over like dominoes. And we had such a great time, you know, working on Scruples. You know, there were times where we would improvise or stuff like that, and we had a really, really great dynamic. And then he saw that when he saw the film was finished, he saw Scruples and was like, you know, I'm really impressed with this. I think you did a fantastic job with this. I mean, first of all, it's a student film which got finished. That is already, you know, an amazing hurdle because, you know, so many of them never see completion or never see, you know, no one ever actually gets to watch them. And he was like, I was so impressed. So I want you to do this with me. And so I was like, great, let's do that. And so we shot that movie in November 2011, 10 years ago this year. And then as we were in post-production, we got notified about Scruples getting into this Venice thing. And so they were like, well, we're going to fly you, the filmmaker, over for this event. And so I'm sitting across from Johan at a desk and I'm like, you want to go to Italy? He's like, of course I do. And so he came over with me and we, and not only that, but a whole bunch of, you know, James, the other lead actor in the movie, he also came along because he happened to be in Europe at the time. This is in that fantastical universe of the past where you could travel internationally and it was really flippant and easy. And so we all went and had an amazing, amazing time. And, you know, and Johan and I are still close to this day. We had lunch at Fox Studios here in Sydney, you know, a couple of weeks ago. So yeah, lifelong friendship.
You know what, that reminded me, I think I know from having been social media friends with you now for 2 years, that when 1917 came out, you said, wonderful, hey everybody, if you like that, watch Forbidden Ground or Battleground.
That's correct. Yeah, I will confess that 1917 is a, it's a little bit better.
I didn't jump on it. I'm going to watch Battleground now that I know, and then I'll send you an email. I'll let you know all the ways your film is better.
That's very, very kind of you to say, you know, but watching Forbidden Ground, you know, we obviously did a lot of research into World War One movies. We watched, you know, a lot of the Pantheon and, you know, that again, it's worthy of its own podcast. One day, maybe we can do a podcast about that once you've seen it. But, you know, that, there's so much of that that I think works really, really well. It's far from a perfect movie, but there's a lot of love, sweat and tears that went into it. And the film sold really well. I mean, you know, it's distributed in the US by Lionsgate. So that's, you know, there's nothing to sneeze at. But watching 1917, I was like, not having the resources or anything that they had, but having worked in that space and that mindset and absorbing that world, I was so enamored with what they did in 1917. That's actually one of my favorite movies of all time already. Now I think it's incredible.
It's great. I love Sam Mendes too.
He's just amazing. Even though watching everything. American Beauty now is like the most surreal thing you could possibly imagine. You know, it's talk about a movie that doesn't hold up. And that's a movie when I was younger back in 99, I thought American Beauty was an unbelievable film. You know, it was one of my, I would watch that recreationally just because I thought it was such a profound movie, and watching it now it's like, oh.
For a variety of reasons, I assume.
For almost so many, yeah, for dozens of reasons.
Dozens of reasons. All right, so now I think I know where we're at in 2012, but I don't meet you. And by the way, thank you. I should have said this in the intro. You wanted to come to Los Angeles in general to spend some time in LA. I think you said you come to California. You tried to come once a year before the world closed. And we didn't know when you came in November 2019 to the Sherman Oaks Film Festival, we didn't know that we were about less than 3 months away from the planet shutting down.
Exactly. Exactly.
But you came in person from Australia to the Sherman Oaks Film Festival, which I am eternally grateful about.
And it was fantastic. You know, it's a very, very, you know, we were emailing about this the other day. It's such a surreal thing that's taken on this weight, you know, because when we got in, so the festival, you know, as you said, you know, we try to go, we definitely try to get to LA like once a year, both for meetings, to see friends, you know, and also because we love the city. And, you know, my sister lives in New York. So there's all sorts of reasons for it. And, you know, being here in Sydney, we just got to, you know, it's a long flight, but it's just over the Pacific. You know what I mean? Like it's, you know, you get on and then you're there. Like, so at least you don't have to swap. But you know, and I actually really love LA, and I, you know, I'm always happy and keen for a chance to go there. But when the film got in, you know, I was so delighted, and you know, the festival has got such a great rep, and you know, the communication and the presentation was so warm and lovely. So it was like, yeah, look, let's, you know, I said to Jess, my producer and my partner, you know, I was like, do you want to go? I mean, like, you know, we can do so many great things there, and you know, this looks like a wonderful festival. And she's like, yeah, absolutely, let's do it. And so we made a real vacation of it. I did meetings and whatnot, but we also really, you know, even though, again, Jess and I have been to LA 5 or 6 times together, we're like, let's really lean into this and do some touristy stuff and go out and really, you know, stretch our legs and, you know, let's go see Pulp Fiction at, you know, the Beverly and, you know, in the New Beverly and really just kind of lean into some LA stuff. And we caught up with so many great friends, and then the festival was so delightful. We had such a great time, and you guys were all so wonderful, and the other films there were so awesome, and the vibe was great. And as you say, then we got home and everything fell down, and we were like, okay. So Jess and I are looking at each other going, that was the last international vacation we're having for years now at this point. Okay, well, at least it was a damn good one.
And for us, it was a film. We still haven't had another film festival. I believe we're going to be in the theater again in this November, 2 years later. But my the muscles are not strong. I'm a little nervous about it. I'm like, so we're going to be in person, right? But we're jumping. So Brolga, I now in my mind have various pieces of Brolga. Now I know that you started it in film school.
I did.
And it was a 35-minute beast. And so the footage I saw existed then. So because, as I recall from the Q&A, you went to Chernobyl, Ukraine, to get your post-apocalyptic shots.
Yeah. So basically, you know, again, just speaking to the grace and luck that I've had in my career, after Forbidden Ground, I kept securing work, working as a feature editor, working as a corporate video editor, music videos, documentaries, developing scripts, working on lots and lots of other stuff. Really wonderfully lucky to be able to develop and foster a professional film industry career. But what that meant was that 35-minute cut of Brolga that was quite literally on a shelf, on a hard drive, on a shelf, I just never got the time to go back to it. It might sound lazy or might sound like an excuse, but, you know, various other things were going on. And, you know, it was just one of those things where I don't know if anyone else can relate to this, but I almost take a perverse pleasure sometimes in having something that you can look forward to as a thing, you know, like, okay, you know, when this isn't happening, I've got something over there, a project that I can look forward to working on. Not that I was, you know, keeping it deliberately in my back pocket and pushing it off, but, you know, it was this weird nebulous thing of I'm working, and that's there, and I'll get to that one day, you know, thinking I'll get to it in a, I'm thinking, you know, I'll get to it in 6 months, you know, I'll get to it in XYZ. And then suddenly, 7 years have gone by, and, you know, the film's not complete. You know, it was never complete. Even the 35-minute cut that we showed was not, you know, this was full of cards going, insert this, insert that, which is another one of the reasons why, you know, it languished for so long. It sat on the shelf for so long because I didn't have the money or the means or the resources to kind of do that. But it got to this stage where years had gone by and I still maintained contact with so many of the people that worked on it with me, that I was like, I really have to finish that. Like, now it's getting ridiculous. Now I've gotten to the point where I'm just wasting time and I'm disrespecting the people that went above and beyond to work on this project. It's actually getting ridiculous now. So I pulled it off the shelf and looked at it and I thought, well, one of the philosophies in filmmaking that I've always subscribed to, and I know a bunch of other people do, is that, you know, if every film could be put in a drawer for a year and then pulled out and worked on again, we would have many, many better films. Like, it's true of, I think, of, you know, it's kind of true of virtually any human enterprise, but it's certainly true of creative stuff, and it's really true of movies. When you're editing a film, the more time you can have away from it before you lock it, the better it's going to be because you get that objectivity back. That, coupled with the fact that I just spent 7 years working as a professional feature film editor, meant that I came back to this project with a completely different perspective. And I took it off the shelf, fired it up, and went, okay, great. I know exactly what to do to this. I know exactly what I need to do. And that time away, that development, that maturity meant that, yeah, it all just clicked into place. It still meant that I was like, okay, I'm going to start working on this. And it still took a couple of months to get that into shape and refining it and polishing it. But I then got that into a state that I thought was working really, really well. And then right around that time, now we're talking early 2018, my partner, Jess, whose family hails from Ukraine, said, you know, we are planning to do a family vacation back to Ukraine because, you know, my parents haven't been there since the 1970s. I've never been there. And they want to kind of go back and get in touch with their roots because, you know, they were there when it was still the Soviet Union. So it was like, okay, of course, I understand. And they're like, she's like, well, we're going to go. Do you want to come? And I was like, of course I want to. Like, you know, should we go as a couple? And I was like, absolutely. And then I said, okay, well, while we're going, let's go to the UK and we'll go to Scotland and Ireland and all the places where my family hails from. So we'll make it a big ancestral legacy adventure. And we did that and it was fantastic. But as we were kind of making the final preparations to go, she was like, let's go to Chernobyl. And I went, what? Like, what are you talking about? And she's like, we should go. It's a really, really hot, well, not hot, it's a really, really popular tourist destination. And I was like, that's ridiculous. I'm absolutely not. And as Jess will attest, I'm very, very committed to self-preservation. So I was like, I'm not a thrill-seeking kind of person. I was like, absolutely not. And then she's like, okay, trust me, you're being overreactive. It's completely safe. Or rather, you know, it's safe for you to go to for this purpose. And I was like, no way. She's like, all right. She went away and she came back to me with the research, with the information. She showed me, here's the Geiger counter readouts. Here is all the scientific stuff. Here's all the people, you know, like, Adrian, just go hashtag Chernobyl on your thing. You'll see people going there. And she showed me this stuff. And I was like, oh, okay, that's kind of compelling. And then the final, you know, nail in the coffin was, she's like, have a look at this YouTube video. And it was a YouTube video with some radiologist or, you know, folks from Cambridge University. And they said, okay, we're going to demonstrate something. And there's a shot of them in the grounds of the university, and they've got a Geiger counter on, a little personal Geiger counter. And they're like, okay, here's our radiation. Well, we're standing here in the middle of the grounds of Cambridge University. And then they do a smash cut. And they're like, here we are in Chernobyl. And it's negligible. Like, the radiation difference is negligible. And then they do another cut and they go, here we are on the plane flying from Cambridge to Ukraine. And the radiation being in the plane is spiking through the roof because we're so much higher to like UV and all that kind of stuff. And they're like, the amount of radiation you're getting traveling between these two countries is of an astronomically higher ratio than what you're getting by being there for a couple of hours. And I was like, okay, I'm convinced.
And from the beginning, was she pitching that you could shoot footage for Brolga there, or when did that?
She actually wasn't. It was when I suddenly was like, okay, let's do this. And it was almost in the same thought where I was like, you know, we could go there and we could shoot all this material I need, because one of the main things that had come back feedback on the movie was, we don't really know what the context for this story is. We don't know if it's in the future. We don't know if it's in the bush. We don't really know where it's taking place. And so when I came back to the movie, looking at it off the shelf after all those years, I was like, okay, one of the main things we need is context. We need to establish the world. We need to really be clear about what's going on. And so I thought, great, we'll be able to get some of this stuff in Chernobyl, being mindful that there's a lot of iconography and a lot of landmarks in Chernobyl that are fairly famous now. And I will preface, this comes back at the end of this story, but this is all pre the Chernobyl TV show. The show had not happened. I had not been released, rather, at this point. And so to fast forward a little bit, we travel over to there, and it's the day that we're going to go to Ukraine. And I've decided that I'm going to use my iPhone, because at the time I had the iPhone X or the iPhone 10. I can't remember which one it's supposed to be called, which had a fantastic camera. And even though the rest of the film had been shot on the Red Epic, I was like, for the amount of shots that we're trying to do in the way that I'm going to treat them visually, I think we can get away with this. And so I got a DJI Osmo Mobile 2 gimbal and took my phone and we set off to go there. And on the bus ride to Chernobyl, the tour guides, who were wonderful, wonderful people from, I think it's just ChernobylTour.com, if I recall correctly. They're thanked in the credits of the film. They put on a documentary, because it's a two-hour bus ride or something from Kiev to Chernobyl, which is still insane when you think about it, how little distance that is. They put this documentary on, and I confess that I had an understanding of what the nature of the Chernobyl disaster was. It happened in the year of my birth. It has been prevalently used in a lot of fiction and nonfiction that I've read throughout the years, but it was only watching this documentary that we became really aware of the incredible scope and nature of the toll, the human disaster that was there. it was my ignorance that had prevented me from really considering and contemplating the full extent of what that was. And then watching that, the nightmarish horror that emerged from that, and the unbelievable heroism that emerged from that, you know, suddenly I was like, oh, okay, right. So I'm looking at this with this admittedly like a really exploitative attitude. I'm going like, oh, go get and get some more shots for the movie. And it's like, this is a graveyard, guys. Like this, this deserves an immense respect. I was happy with the extent that which we had tried to honor and respect all of the first Australian material, which is innately tied into the nature of the story. But I was like, I'm over here and I'm looking at this with a really exploitative attitude. So that informed my attitude going into this, and I was mindful and careful about what we were going to do. And it was never my intention to shoot like the Chernobyl Ferris wheel or anything like that. That would have been kitsch just on its own terms. But it was like, okay, we really have to be mindful of this and be conscious of the space. And so there is material from Chernobyl in the movie, but it's nothing that you would go, oh, you know, that's Chernobyl, or, oh, that's a, you know, that's the money shot or whatever. They're really just little glimpses of a place that's kind of frozen in time. And we ultimately ended up supplementing a lot of those establishing shots with some digital effects and some other locations here in Australia where I went and shot. But that, you know, there are certainly shots from Chernobyl in the film. And, you know, I think that their inclusion has allowed me to have this conversation with a bunch of people. I will say, when we were leaving the site on the bus back, I was like, someone should do a series about that. And then, you know, lo and behold, 15 minutes later, they do the press release for this new show. And then obviously when the Chernobyl series came out, everyone finally had the opportunity to learn what happened, because they did a great job of encapsulating that. And so now I feel that people have got a more informed, educated opinion on Chernobyl. But even to this day, I'm still learning. You know, I promoted the film in the film's liner notes. You know, it was like, you know, part of the production was shot in Chernobyl. The end credits of the movie feature, you know, this was filmed in Gadigal country, you know, here in Australia, and Chernobyl. And I got some feedback from Ukrainian people going, just FYI, you've not spelt it correctly. You've spelt it with the Russian spelling. We spell it with two O's. That's the Ukrainian spelling. We're trying to reclaim that. So we'd appreciate if, you know, and I mean, I'm making it sound like a PR agency. These are just people messaging me on social media going like, just FYI, you should probably change that. And I was like, okay, great. That's really good. So, you know, that's good for me to know. At the end of the day, going to Chernobyl was unbelievable. It was haunting. It was educational. It was charming because the people that were there, were so wonderful and so warm and so inviting, and yet so educational. I really recommend it. But I just don't know when that's going to be a viable thing to do.
Listening to all that, you inspired memories for me. I graduated high school the year of your birth when Chernobyl blew, and it's easy to forget that the Soviet Union completely locked all information about it at the time. All we knew is that there was a meltdown and they prevented it from being... They presented it to us like disaster was avoided, right? It didn't completely send a cloud of radioactive smoke, essentially, across the rest of Europe. Like, and that show was amazing. Chernobyl was amazing to see just how close it was and how many people gave their lives. Miners going under it. I mean, we could talk about that show for an hour as well, but. If you were alive in 1986, and actually I was 18 years old, so I was old enough to know. I mean, we didn't know anything about it because the Soviet Union was so closed in.
Yeah.
So.
It, absolutely right. And, you know, speaking to Jess's parents, you know, they had fled, they had left Ukraine as Jewish immigrants, you know, like immigrating to Australia in 1979. So they were lucky to miss it. But, you know, they spoke to the fact, you know, even when we were talking about it, they spoke to the fact that, you know, oh, no, it's all, you know, there was a cover up, you know, all this was locked down. However, the show, the documentary, we learned several other sources speak to the fact that, you know, it's not even a giant evil Soviet red conspiracy. Gorbachev himself, you know, the premier of the Union, was this information was hidden from him, like from throughout the pipeline. There were middlemen throughout the pipeline that were like, oh, nuts, this is my fault. It's all going to come raining down on me. Cover it up. And so if you can imagine, like, imagine a nuclear disaster happening in the United States or happening here in Australia and the president or the prime minister not being made aware of it. It's absolutely insane, or maybe not. How do we know? We know what goes on behind the scenes. But on that topic, I highly recommend, I'm not sure if you've seen it, but certainly for the listeners, if you ever get a chance to see Werner Herzog's documentary from just a couple of years ago, which is, I think it's just called Gorbachev. It might be something else, but he did this documentary, which is just a series, or maybe it's interviews with Gorbachev. It's just a series of interviews with him about his life up until this very day, or, you know, very, very recently. And it's an unbelievable documentary, absolutely unbelievable. But then when they get to the talking about Chernobyl and he speaks about how he was kept out of the loop and how that was one of the many dominoes that ultimately led to him being ousted and the ultimate collapse, you know, it's a hugely formative part of the development of the 20th century. And it's just a huge mess. and as you say, it came down to a whole bunch of brave working class people who, admittedly, if they had opted out of doing what they did, they would have been shot. So it's not like they really had a choice. But those guys were still like, well, if we don't do this, the world's kind of screwed, because it was going to collapse underneath and poison the water. And, you know, they were like, well, someone's got to do it. Real heroes.
And they were probably going to die because they were too close anyway.
Oh, they were goners. But they were like,
and when you mentioned all the middle managers, if it happened in Australia or the United States, a nuclear reactor melting down, the middle managers lose their jobs, maybe have a hard time getting another job. In the Soviet Union, they are actually sent to Siberia and are killed immediately. Like it was a death sentence to make a mistake in that.
Absolutely right. And look at that. And that environment and fostered such a culture of fear that didn't work out too well. Anyway, there's our geopolitical section of the podcast.
Wonderful. A wonderful tangent. And so it brings us back to, I'll just bring us right back to Brolga. So a little bit, by the way, I have to ask, was the shopping center image, was that Chernobyl? The destroyed? That is actually one of my favorite images in the introduction, because you just use that to completely communicate that, you know, the world as we know it is gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that completely sets the table for Brolga and the story that follows.
Yeah. And, you know, there's the shot actually that immediately precedes that is a shot of the exterior of that building. You know, that's actually the building and the interior of that building. There is a piece of graffiti on the wall of a baby going like this, like poking his tongue out. And when we were there, I said to Jess, and I said, doesn't that look like Trump? Doesn't the baby look like Trump? And she was like, it kind of does. And then there was another couple, a couple of feet away, American couple, and they were like, Jesus, it looks like Trump. and so watch that again. Look at that thing. It looks like a baby Donald Trump going, nah, on the wall. It's weird. And insane. I was like, that's got to go in. That's going in.
Insane. So I want to ask, was there anything, did you reshoot, do any Australian reshoots in 2018 as well?
We did. That was a funny little thing. So we shot a lot of that exterior, you know, those establishing shots and, you know, I went, you know, all the drone shots, we went and got those as well, you know, because obviously 2011, there were no drones, you know, there's nothing like that. If you wanted to get an aerial shot like that, you had to hire a helicopter, you know, so we didn't have anything like that. But now, just go for a 40-minute drive out of Sydney with your drone and you can get shots like that. So that obviously added to the production value and the storytelling, and the geography of the piece. But we actually did get a bunch of other little pickups, and this is super normal, especially, you know, in the editorial process. You put stuff together and you realize that you missed stuff, or you didn't have stuff that you needed, or you don't have a thing to make an idea that you have in editorial work. You're like, if we only had that, then we could do this, and that would solve a problem. In the case of Brolga, it was all little inserts and kind of close-up pickups. So when we shot the movie, there were a bunch of little actions that we just didn't get or just didn't think that we needed. And I'm talking literally like there's shots where like a character will just turn their head. You know, the close-up, I don't want to spoil the movie for anyone who hasn't seen the film, but, you know, the knife, you know, the storyteller's knife, the close-up of the knife hitting the ground at the end, that's an insert. One of my favorite things about the whole reshoot or the pickups process was one of the things that we never sufficiently got was the bit at the end where James Shepard, who plays the scavenger, there's a bit where he pulls a knife out of his coat. And we never got it on the day, and it was always going to be, we'll pick that up later and later. And it's like, okay, we never got the shot with the knife. I need a mid shot of him pulling that knife out of his coat to insert into what we already have shot. And I need a shot of him crouching down to see that knife kind of being brandished over the storyteller. Okay, what are we going to do about this? So I got in touch with James. James and I are still friends, still buddies. And I was like, hey, man. And I mean, you know, it was surreal going back to all these actors, James Shepard, James Saunders, Tiani Couplin. They've all aged 10 years. Tiani, who was, you know, like 11 years old when we shot the movie, is now in her 20s, you know. And so I'm like, hey, guys, guess what? I'm actually going to finally finish this thing, and I need everyone to come in and do ADR and do a bunch of stuff, which is a hilarious story on its own. But I went to James and I said, okay, James, I need to get some insert shots of you prowling around and pulling out this knife. I don't suppose you've still got that giant jacket that we bought for the thing, because I bought that big – the jacket that he's wearing in the movie is a Swiss medical military jacket. It's, you know, for battlefield medic jacket. Which I bought at a military supply store, and he wears throughout the movie. And at the end of the shoot, he was like, this jacket's really great. Do you mind if I keep this jacket? And I was like, yeah, keep the jacket. It's a giant hulking thing. When I put it on, it was heavy and horrible on me, but he's so tall that it worked great. Now he was like, I was like, keep the jacket. I said, you don't still have the jacket, dude. He was like, I've still got the jacket. I've definitely still got the jacket. Like 7 years later, whatever it was. And I was like, you don't happen to have a prop knife that looks like something that we would find in that world, do you? And he goes, like this? And he holds up that knife that's in the thing. And I was like, that's perfect. And he's like, okay, so then I guess we got to go back to the location. And I said, well, we don't have to go back to the location. The location where we shot most of the original film is actually right in the middle of Sydney Harbour at a place called Ball's Head. It's a little outcropping of it's a nature reserve that crops out into the harbour. But literally, as I've said to people, who know the area, in so many shots in Brolga, if you flung the camera just to the right, just a few feet, you would see so many houses, you'd see boats. And I'm talking like affluent, wealthy Sydney Harbour Bridge view houses. It's completely fabricated, the whole thing. He's like, okay, we're going to go over there. And I was like, actually, where I live now, which is across the harbour, there's a whole big outcropping of rock. I mean, looking at it now, it's just across the harbor. It's the same rock. It's just been weathered down, you know, over thousands and thousands of that. But it's actually the same rock. Let's just go down there and shoot it against that, and we'll see how we go. We went down. Took us about 20 minutes to shoot all those things. Again, just shooting it on my iPhone. Shot it all. Graded it. Cut it into the movie. No one has ever been able to discern that they are pickups. No one has ever gone, that's an iPhone shot intercut with a Red camera shot. No one has ever said a word. Those are really rewarding. In a weird way, they're some of the most rewarding things to me in the movie, because the illusion just worked. It's funny.
The illusion works perfectly. I can say, as someone who's seen it on a 20-foot screen as well as multiple times at home, I would have never guessed. I mean, I would guess there was pickups. I wouldn't guess there was a 7-year break, as well as international. I mean, I knew about the international locations after watching it, but yeah, no. There's no giveaway. There's no giveaway that the actors have, that the actor might have aged. Nothing. It's seamless. It's completely seamless.
It was so funny because we came in to do ADR, and you know, to be fair, like James and James. you know, they still look great. I mean, again, they're you know, they're actors. They looked great then. They look great now. Tiani, again, she was a child when we did this thing. She was one of the best actors I've ever worked with. She was an unbelievable performer who had a whole bunch of experience, like prior to that. And she was like, you know, took direction just like a champ, amazing worker. But again, she was a kid. And so when I was like, hey, I need to do ADR for that line that you have. Again, spoilers. She doesn't have that much dialogue in the film, but the line she does have is meaningful. And I was like, I don't have that as a recording. Is it ridiculous that we try to record you and then we pitch it up and you know what happens? She's like, well, look, let's just try. So we came into this to the sound recording booth and, you know, we've got, the sound for the film was done at Trackdown Studios at Fox Studios Australia. So that's a world-class team. That's probably the best sound team in Australia who I've worked with before on Forbidden Ground and a bunch of other stuff. My office was in there for a while. And so I know them all really well. They're friends. And I was like, I want you guys to do this because I want to give the film the treatment it deserves. And so Tiani comes in and the sound technician's like, she's grown up. And I was like, yeah, I know. Let's just try this. And she was like, okay, look, we can experiment with pitching her up and whatnot. But look, just be mindful. This might be a bit tough. And I was like, yeah, cool. That's no problem. Tiani goes in, delivers the line, first try, just delivers it as a performance. That's what's in the film. And the sound technician turns to me and she goes, holy crap. Like that's like it literally, she just sounds like a 12-year-old girl again. And that's not what Tiani sounds like now. Like she sounds like a woman. But
right, she performed as 12.
She performed as 12, and no one has gone, that didn't sound like a 12-year-old girl in the movie. Like nothing. And I was just like, that's unbelievable. And they did not even pitch it up or do any treatment to it. It is just what it is in the film. That's just a testament to her getting back into that headspace. So yeah, bringing everyone back after a while was certainly surreal, but again, subscribing to that philosophy of put the film in the drawer and then come back to it later, you know, it would not have been the same film if we had released it earlier. It would not have been as successful as it has been in terms of a film for audience, and it would not have been as satisfying for me.
And as I recall from the Q&A in 2019, you hadn't decided to go black and white at first, right?
Yeah, that's a whole thing, right? Because so it was not originally
gorgeous in black and white. It's just, it's a gorgeous film.
Thank you. And I agree. I think that Tim Tregoning, the cinematographer of the movie, did an unbelievable job with a very difficult circumstances. There are times that Tim is shooting that movie, he's got one person in the camera department, maybe two. You know, like camera departments have 15, 20 people sometimes. He's got one person who's got reflector, you know, one person managing a light, maybe who's on the generator or whatever. He did absolute magic. But it was never intended to be in black and white. And that was never my artistic intention for the film. And then when we're on the set, when we're shooting in that little cave and shooting their close-ups as they're doing this story, we're just down there. It's a real cave. And we're in there. It's not the cave that they're going into. There's some sleight of hand what they're going into and the actual interior they're in, but they're only a few meters away from each other. We're sitting there shooting these close-ups at night, and we're like really close, you know, like this far away from each other. He just goes, you know, we should do this movie in black and white. And I went, what? And initially I was like, that's why. I mean, that just sounds like a gimmick. And I was looking at it and he's, you know, when you see the movie, again, spoilers, I hope you've watched the film before you listen to the podcast, the end of the movie when we have those bits that are in color, which are in the cave, and you see the guys in the cave, again, this is a testament to Tim. It's gorgeous. Like you're looking at it and it's like, you know, I grant you, it's not like the most complex image in the world, but it's these guys, these actors' faces, they're silhouetted in deep focus in this cave with this beautiful warm color temperature. It looks really nice. And so I'm looking at this on the monitor going, oh God, that looks beautiful. You're crushing it. And he's like, let's turn it to black and white. And I'm like, that's ridiculous. But that stayed with me. I couldn't get that idea out of my head. And I was like, okay, what would it be like as black and white? And then suddenly I went on this unbelievable journey because, you know, one of the limitations of the film, one of the difficulties of the film was, you know, we didn't have a lot of money. We didn't have a massive production budget. We didn't have enough. We didn't, you know, we were just trying to make do with homemade stuff, basically. And so when you see the film in color, the whole thing, it does not have the same effect, as you can well imagine. Like, but it also kind of looks kind of like a bunch of people dressing up in the bush, you know, and running around and doing a bunch of antics. And obviously it could have been color graded. Like, this is looking at it without a color grade, but it could have been color graded to have a really great cinematic look. But I was like, okay, so first of all, if we go black and white with it, it will give us free production value because it instantly gives you this aesthetic. Now, that's a cheap and easy and, you know, that's it's not really a good excuse to turn your film black and white. That is your cliche, like, oh, cool, you know, turn off the saturation. It looks black and white. That looked cool. Yes. But in this instance, it was like, you know what? It really does help the production aesthetic of the movie. Then it was like, okay, let's not just go black and white. Let's try to lean into treating this film with a specific aesthetic so that the black and white is saying something about the space, you know, so the black and white is saying this is another world, you know, this is another kind of dimensional reality, not literally, but, you know, the film is a sci-fi. And it was like, if we treat it with this, it'll give it this alien feeling. It'll really help to transport the audience into the headspace we want. And then as we were having these conversations, it was like, okay, I'm internally going, what if then we experiment with this and we play with doing certain parts of the film in color? And what does that mean and what does that look like? And talking about that with Michael, you know, the artist, you know, who originally contributed the works to the film and who was responsible for the whole project, you know, even existing and for granting us permission to adapt the story and to speak to us, to speak with us about it. I was like, okay, I think we can get another whole other level of subtext into this movie if we experiment with what that means. And so that then, you know, and we were still so luckily early on in the project when this was kind of happening, you know, it was like, okay, let's keep that in mind for everything we're working towards, we're going to work towards using the color to help tell the story. And so that then contributed to the visual effects and how we treated the cave paintings. And, you know, I actually color graded the film myself, and that allowed and afforded me the time to spend literally months tweaking it, experimenting with it, and doing things that are, again, it's not just pulling the saturation down and turning the contrast up. It's about, I'm going in and really modifying and grading every image, not just, you know, to highlight and accentuate certain things that you'd normally do in a grade, but even doing things like inverting solarization and turning darks into whites and whites into darks and doing things that go, there's something weird about this image. I don't really know what it is, but it's otherworldly. And, you know, the aesthetic of the film is, at the end of the day, it's 95% the amazing work that Tim did. But I've been really rewarded personally that people have responded to the black and white aesthetic, which again was his idea. Let's completely be honest. But working through that, I'm like, boy, am I grateful to Tim for having that idea, because people speak to it as one of the strengths of the movie.
Absolutely. And when you talked about the process you graded the black and white, I absolutely get, while I watch it, it communicates to me how otherworldly it is. And I, in my mind, I just think, you know, it's very high contrast. But then to hear the extra care you put into it, it absolutely does take you. I love how it says Australia soon. So you're not saying when, just soon. But it completely shows us that it's not the world we're in right now. It's a completely different world. And that's right. It just works perfectly. And then I love when the color does come in and the beautiful shot you mentioned. And funny enough, one of the things I love is seeing that the storyteller's sweater's blue. Seeing that color blue for the first time in the whole film, I don't know why, but I have an emotional reaction, I think, to the blue.
Super deliberate. Like the blue was always the intention, and for that reason, and again, I just reveal how much of a dork I am, but I was like, that bit at the end, I'm not going to spoil it, but the final shot of them together in color, you know, that was storyboarded. Like, that's the Superman shot, right? You know, like that's how it's pitched as like the framing. And he's in the blue because, you know, I think, you know, blue stands for so much and it's so invigorating and it works so well against the landscape. But as it's so true, and you're not the first person to say that. Like suddenly when they see, oh my God, that's blue. It's adding this whole other different color spectrum to the thing, and people respond to it. And I'm really touched by that.
Absolutely. And it even adds more to thinking back over the film and thinking how gray it felt.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, to know that gray was actually a hidden blue. It's just,
and he's hiding in the camouflage. You know what I mean? Like it's, you know, it's all, you know, we spent so long, me and James especially, and Fatma, the production designer and wardrobe, you know, she was in charge of wardrobe, going out shopping, finding these pieces, going to thrift stores and stuff like that and gathering these things and then aging them down. And, you know, it's super funny, you know, the outfit that James is wearing, he's got this camo gear, which I liked. I was really into the idea of you know, showing him being almost like very experienced, like almost tactically, you know, he you know, in this future space, he's got a very pragmatic view. He's very conscious about hiding himself. He's very, very deliberate and specific about covering his tracks. He's very smart. He's a survivor. And so I liked having that. He kind of sheds that and it comes out with the blue, which he's been hiding all this time. I love that people respond to that.
And I have to add one more comment that I'm sure is not original and you've heard before, but James, I don't know his last name, but you've called him James. So I now know your lead actor, the storyteller's name.
Yes.
The actor's name is James. Film is a superficial visual medium. And I just have to say, I could look at his face all day. I think his face is amazing and expressive. And just, I think that guy could be, you know, the next Dev Patel, like somebody who could be on screen in 2 hours in a feature, never off camera. And I would never get tired of looking at that man.
I know. And, you know, I totally agree. He's unbelievable. Like that was such an amazing achievement for James, because James, when we met James in the audition, he had only recently started becoming an actor. Like he was very, very only limited experience at that time. But he was still very, very savvy and switched on with what he wanted to achieve and kind of, you know, being honest with his sensibilities and his skills. But he gave a great audition and we were like, look, we want to give you this part. And he was like, okay, I'm really happy about that. But, you know, I was like, now this is like a silent role, you know, like there's a big block of this where you give a monologue. But other than that, it's almost a silent role. And a lot of this is going to be on your face. Like a lot of this is going to be watching your expressions and using that to convey the emotions of the story. And he was like, okay. But it ended up being this really great and fascinating dynamic because James was so fresh to the game. And I had such an idea of what I wanted to achieve with it. That it got to the point where I was like, and when I'm working with any actor on any project, one of the things I love to do is to go out to them at the start of the project and go, hey, how do you like to be directed? Do you have any preferences for your process? How is it for you? What's the most efficient way for us to engage? Because I've got the way that I like to do things, but I also like to possibly tailor that to suit an actor. And some people are like, oh no, I don't, you know, whatever. And some people are like, yeah, I love X, Y, Z. It's like, great. In this instance, I was like, do you have any thoughts on this? He's like, oh, no, not particularly. I was like, okay, conventionally, I like to be minimalist with my directing. I like to let the actor find it to feel comfortable with what they're doing. I like to make suggestions and go like, okay, but consider this, keep this in mind, et cetera, et cetera. I don't like to be prescriptive. I will be prescriptive if I think an actor's given a great performance or they've knocked it out of the park and I go, that was super great. Can I give you, this is almost from an editor's perspective. So I have options. Can I give you a reading of the line, you know, which is a no-no for a lot of people. People don't like to be told how to say lines. And I absolutely understand that. And that's why it's like, you know, I'll be like, great, we've done this. Whenever I'm shooting anything, I'll say at the end of it, great. Can we just bank some reactions? Can we just get you doing some, like not with anyone acting, but just feel the scene you just went through and just channel it emotionally, just so I've got alternate things for your face. Very rarely will I say, great, that was fantastic. We've got that. Can you just try one like this? Typically after doing a big thing, an actor will be like, yeah, for sure. I'd love to. With James, I was like, I'm going to be pretty close by to the camera and just talking to you. Is that okay? And he's like, yeah, that would really help. It would be great. And I was like, okay, great. And so a lot of the movie, a lot of the shoot was just me going, okay, now let's try this. And now think this. Now try this. And sometimes it would be really esoteric and be like, you're feeling this. This is what you're thinking. This is what's happening. This is what's on your mind right now. And other times it would literally be like, turn your head this way, look that way, give me this expression, and then go and then turn away. Just getting all sorts of different stuff. That is really hard for an actor to do, to be like essentially like a robot and to just respond and do these things. A lot of people just cannot do that. And not only did James bring it when he had to do your more conventional stuff, when he's working with the other actors, when he's doing dialogue, he was so great. But just sitting there with like a 50 mil lens, not that far from your face, a bunch of people just leaning over at you in a cave, and you have to bring all this expression. He did such an amazing job. And I'm really happy and privileged to still be a close friend with James. As a matter of fact, we're actually collaborating on another project right now. I'm actually producing and script editing a series that James is writing at the moment. And we really hope to be able to share more about that soon. But I cannot say enough good stuff about James. He's super talented. He's super smart. He's not just an actor, but he's a journalist. He's an activist. You know, he's a great sportsman. He's super focused on the cares and concerns of the First Nation communities and cultures. And he's just a great guy.
Fantastic. Well, we've discussed Brogue a lot. Normally where I go next is what you've done since. And yet I know that after Brogue lockdown happened, but I believe a lot of your work was able to continue a bit because it is luckily a luxury to be an editor, I assume, during lockdown.
Right. Well, it's also a luxury to be a writer. You know what I mean? Right. Like in this, it's like two things that you can just do on your own, or rather, you know, somewhat on your own. I've been lucky enough, again, as I mentioned earlier, to be working essentially, as an independent sole contracting filmmaker for the last 10 years, working as a writer, director, and an editor. My bread and butter, my regular everyday, you know, money comes from doing editing work. That's true. But I've always been focused on getting more, you know, directing and writing stuff up. Whilst it was true, I did have a couple of great things to edit while we were in lockdown. The really great opportunity that came up in 2020, really not that long after we returned from LA after visiting you guys, was I was contacted by my good buddy Steve Jaggi, who's a filmmaker and producer who I've worked with now since 2014. I've edited a bunch of movies for Steve, a bunch of TV and stuff with him, docos, I should say, stuff like that. And Steve got in touch with me and he's like, okay, so I'm putting together my first TV show, which I had known about for some while, called Dive Club, which is this show about four girls who live in this coastal island community in Australia. It's a fictitious place, but this big kind of community. We're going to world build this community. And it's a story about these girls who run this dive club. They go out, they love diving, they love being in the ocean, they love recovering not only antiquated relics, but they love, you know, it's an island town, so lots of people lose stuff in the water, and people coming over from the mainland lose stuff in the water. And so they love retrieving stuff that's been lost and returning it to their owners, sometimes decades after it was lost. It's a really sweet concept. But what happens is the notion for this show is that there is a storm, a huge hurricane, and one of the girls disappears in this storm. The island at large believes that it's a tragic accident and she's been lost, but the girls start to uncover a conspiracy that suggests that she might have been made to disappear because she discovered something. And I know that Steve, again, we've been buddies now for a while. He'd been fostering this idea for a while, and he finally got it up with Netflix. As a Netflix original show, in collaboration with a few other companies here in Australia, and he said, "Okay, I know you know you've been working with me. We'd edited about 10 films together at that stage." He goes, "I'm obviously aware of your desires to continue to write and direct, and I want to help you know continue to foster those. So I would love, and I should preface that before this, I had already written a script for Steve with my writing collaborator, Kyra Bradshaw, who's, you know, one of my closest friends for about 15 years now, and we're professional collaborators when it comes to writing. We'd written a script for him to kind of demonstrate that we had what it take to do that, had what it took to do that, and he loved that script, and we hoped to one day to be able to get that script made, but right now that's on ice because that's kind of an international co-production that does require a bunch of stuff to be shot in the US. So that's on hold for the moment, but that demonstrated that we could do what it took. And he's like, we would love for you guys to come on board and to write some episodes of this show. And we were like, that's an unbelievable opportunity. This is a show that's going to be broadcast worldwide, 190 countries, whatever it is, Netflix worldwide. And we just leapt at the opportunity. And we were actually writing another feature. We were writing a rom-com at the time. Also, hopefully, you know, we've just received some fantastic feedback about that film, but we had to put that on ice to do a writer's room for a Netflix show in lockdown. And so, as we called it, you know, became the writer's Zoom. We had, you know, me and Kyra, and even though we're both here in Sydney, obviously at the height of lockdown, we were both in our apartments. Then we had Claire, our other writer, who was in Melbourne. We had Georgia, our head writer, who was in Queensland. And we had Drew, our other writer, and I think he was in Sydney, but he might have been even in WA, Western Australia, possibly. Anyway, we all kind of got together and were doing these Zooms, and we're talking like 12-hour Zooms, 7 days a week for weeks, because it was like, we've got to get rolling on this because, you know, they're like, okay, we can do a COVID bubble for the production up in northern Queensland. It's actually possible and sustainable to do a completely isolated community shoot. COVID testing, no one's allowed to leave the bubble, et cetera, et cetera. We can get rolling on this now. So we need to get it sorted out. And so we kind of came on board this project and we're like, okay, well, we've got a rough outline for the story of the series, but we need to kind of dig in and expand that, allocate episodes. So that was a really intense process, but it was great. It was fantastic. We had a wonderful time, and Dive Club had an early kind of sneak release here in Australia a month or two ago here on a local Australian kind of streaming service, just as a kind of out of town off Broadway premiere. But we just received the word that it's going to be coming out sometime really soon now worldwide on Netflix. Netflix just dropped the trailer for it on the Netflix Futures YouTube channel. So for those of you that don't know, there's the Netflix YouTube channel, and then there's the Netflix Futures channel, which is where you go for stuff that's not officially announced by Netflix, but it's announced by Netflix Futures. So it's not on the platform yet, but it will be soon. And we're super excited for that and hope that, when everyone gets a chance to check it out, they're going to like what they see.
That's very exciting. And as a streaming binger, I think we've all become streaming bingers. Even before lockdown, I'm very excited. I'm very excited that I'm going to get to see Dive Club.
Yeah, look, it's obviously, I would say that the target demographic for the show, ideally, you know, it is obviously for teens, maybe for younger teens. It's a show that would really, it really appeals, I feel, from like, probably like, I think the scope of people that have really responded to it is like your 10 to 16, and that seems like a large demographic, but it's very well made. Rhiannon, Haley, and Christine, our directors, just did such a beautiful job with it. It's so cinematic. It really does look like a cinematic treatment for a show. But the great thing about it is I think that you can watch it at any age and still get something out of it, because at the end of the day, it's a missing persons / conspiracy. Is there a secret in this small town kind of thing? And that kind of makes it compelling for any demographic. You're still like, okay, this is not for my age group. I mean, if the amount of times that people have gone like, okay, so I caught the pilot. This is obviously, it's not for, I'm a 45-year-old man, you know, it's not for me, but what happens? I'm like, you've got to watch the show. You've got to figure out what goes on. So I think people will really like it.
Well, and you may not know, but we have a 13-year-old female in the house, and we always let her choose our entertainment. Too often she chooses Criminal Minds, which is way too dark for her. But when you say 10 to 16, I'm like, well, she's going to be 14 in October, so I can pitch Dive Club to her.
I would pitch that to her, and you can reassure her that it was made by a bunch of people in a room going, we remember what it's like to be 13. What did we want to see when we were 13? And, you know, it's great because it's a predominantly led female production, all female directors, predominantly female writers. And there was a lot of conversations just between the writers' room going like, girls, we really do want to be mainly, we're speaking to a predominantly female audience with this, even though there are lots of, you know, male characters in it and it doesn't have to be just for girls, but the protagonists are girls. What did you want to see? And they're like, oh, we've got a list of stuff that we wanted to see. So I think it speaks to the demographic, you know, pretty well. We do try to capture it. But at the same time, the great thing about the show is that it has this kind of ethereal quality. It takes place in a fictional, almost idealized space where, you know, I think once you see it, Cape Mercy, the place where it takes place, you'd be like, man, I want to do a vacation to Cape Mercy. I think it'd be pretty nice.
Well, superb. Well, I think that brings us up to today. So maybe we'll wrap it up and then we'll do your four questions.
Sure.
Anyone who wants to look you up, I didn't warn you about this, but before I jump in and name all the websites and social media handles for the festivals and the TV series, do you want to give people something to follow?
Yeah, I mean, by all means, I'd love everyone to hop on and just like add me on the socials. I'm a glorified nobody, so I love hopping on and people talking about movies. So on Twitter, I'm Adrian J. Powers. Instagram, I think it's also Adrian J. Powers. Add me on Facebook, and please on YouTube. Like my YouTube, if there's one of them you're going to do, please go for a YouTube follow. Head on and check out Brolga. To find it, you've just got it. You know, it's on Discover Indie Film. You can see it there. It's on YouTube. Just type in Brolga. You'll see it there. And if you enjoy the film, please do give it a like and consider giving me a subscribe. I'm also developing kind of just two camera content for my YouTube channel where I'm just kind of pontificating and talking about things. The whole angle is just why I like certain things. The whole it's discussing pop culture and movies and TV, steering away from this is why this didn't work or why I don't think this worked, but talking about here is specifically why I like certain things. And you know, the response to it so far, the first one was why I loved Wonder Woman 84, and you got some very very enthusiastic feedback on that either way.
Absolutely. And I promise to everyone listening, we'll have a link to Adrian's YouTube on if you go to discoveryindiefilm.com and go to the page that's for this episode. We'll link it right there.
Thank you, sir.
And with that, I'll say, and by the way, you should like all his stuff on YouTube and follow him on YouTube. And the Discovery Indie Film TV series on Amazon Prime. 5 stars, everybody. Actually, this podcast, 5 stars. If you're listening to this, and I hope you still are, I hope you didn't stop the minute that Adrian stopped speaking. Give everything, everyone you hear, 5 stars. Just be a nice person and give everyone 5 stars. And with that said, the TV series is just... Oh, wait, I wanted to add one more thing, which is I bothered to look at the latest Brolga. I saw 34 laurels on the poster. Yeah. So I just want to say, when I tell everyone that it's a wonderful film and that you should absolutely go to Amazon Prime Video and go to Discovery Indie Film and watch it, it's season 3, episode 4. But I'm not the only one who thinks it's great because you got 34 laurels on at this point.
From a bunch of wonderful film festivals who are gracious enough to include us like yourself.
Absolutely. All right, so DiscoveryIndieFilm.com is, I should say that slower, DiscoverIndieFilm.com is the website where you can learn all about the TV series on Amazon Prime or this podcast that gave birth to the TV series. And if you want to follow it on social media, it's at DIFWINS. And of course, we mentioned the Sherman Oaks Film Festival. That's every November here in Sherman Oaks. And you learn more about that if you go to ShermanOaksFF.com or on social media, it's at ShermanOaksFF. And there is a sister festival, Film Invasion Los Angeles, that takes place in June. And that's FilmInvasionLA.com and at FilmInvasionLA on social media. And I think I've said it all. So I'm going to thank Adrian for a wonderful interview.
Thank you, sir. It was such a pleasure. I've been looking forward to this for I mean, literally years now, right? And it's been great. I just want to thank you again. Just so great. So grateful that you screened the film. We had such a wonderful time at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival. I pushed it to a bunch of, you know, people like, film festivals I should enter. I was like, definitely do the Sherman Oaks Film Festival in LA. They're great. And yeah, we had such a wonderful time. And it's so great that we've stayed in touch. Really appreciate it, dude.
I appreciate it too. And thank you so much for the kind words. And thank you for submitting a wonderful film. As I often say to filmmakers like yourself, you don't know what it's like to watch 600 films in a 2 to 3 month period. And when you watch 15 not so wonderful films in a row and you start to get depressed and think to yourself, oh my God, what's going to happen this year? And then you see a Brolga and you're like, oh, we're going to have a film festival. That's what's going to happen. So thank you so much for submitting.
That warms my heart.